The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated, wait for it, July 4/11/2022. Here we have Time as usual with the front border in red, the narrow inner border in white, Time in large capital block letters. It's mostly in white, or shades of white and off-white superimposed upon a white and gray in gradations background. The Oceans Issue is the name of this. Water's Untapped Power by Tom Vanderbilt. That will be the opening story. And this features that sculpture, which looks like a crashing wave off the coast of Hawaii or California, but it's actually a plastic sculpture, and it looks like a wave with darker flowing waters beneath and the foamy white waters atop. Turning now to the story by Tom Vanderbilt, a rising tide lifts all grids. Underwater turbines already are harnessing a power source so reliable you can set your clock to it. And that is by Tom Vanderbilt, probably with additional reporting. Nope, Tom Vanderbilt. There's another photo here. It's actually a two-page photo of real water. It is foamy on top, but no crashing waves. Lots of waves, lots of blues and greens and whites with the foam atop. And in the background, brown cliffs with green grass or vegetation atop them. And behind these cliffs in the foreground, more taller cliffs. And behind that, white clouds and blue sky. The caption reads, "Waves crash against the cliffs of the Orkney Islands, whose unique geography have made it a global hub for tidal power." In 1851, Charles Babbage, that's B-A-B-B-A-G-E, the English mathematician and inventor, found himself preoccupied with what might happen should coal mines, then and now one of the primary sources of usable energy, become depleted. He concluded that the sea itself offers a perennial source of power hitherto almost unapplied. And that was a quote from Babbage. Babbage was talking about tides, those lunar-guided movements of the world's oceans, and the very synonym of dependable constancy. But while his difference engine, a mechanical calculator seen as a seminal forerunner to the computer, would essentially go on to remake our world, Babbage's ideas about tidal power drifted in the undercurrent for the next century and a half, largely the province of dreamers. Lately, however, buoyed by successful demonstration projects and a new interest in renewable energy, bolstered even further by Europe's anticipated turning off of Russian taps, tidal energy is moving increasingly into the mainstream. While the number of megawatts produced annually by tidal in places from Canada's Bay of Fundy to South Korea's Siwa Lake is still small, notes Donna Cagney, policy director for the advocacy group Ocean Energy Europe. The increase is exponential. For example, by 2050, tidal energy is expected to account for 11% of the UK's electricity, compared with just 3% today. But in remote coastal Scotland, some residents are already getting a taste of that future. Scotland has become to tidal energy what Saudi Arabia is to fossil fuels. Cagney chalks this up to several factors, ranging from its geography. The country's blessed with some of the world's fastest moving tidal sounds, to its experience in working with offshore oil extraction. For those reasons, it has for almost two decades hosted the world's biggest grid-connected test bed for tidal energy, the European Marine Energy Center, EMEC. Founded in 2003, it is headquartered in the Orkney Islands off Scotland's northern coast. Neil Kermode, the center's director since 2005, has seen some 35 tidal energy projects tested by startups that have come and gone, some shuttered for lack of capitalization or non-viable technology, some absorbed by larger companies like GE. But the biggest project ever run at EMEC, E-M-E-C, is still there, providing power for 1 in 12 Orcadian households. The 02, or O2, probably, as it is dubbed, created by the Scottish company Orbital Marine, weighs some 680 tons, is longer than a Boeing 747, and skims the top of the water like the world's largest rowing scull. It looks like, well, a yellow submarine, says Kermode. When you see it and the tide is roaring past, it's really hard to realize it is stationary. There's a real optical illusion. You think this thing is being towed through the water. But the O2 is chained to the seabed via four cables, each capable of lifting some 50 double-decker buses off the ground. Only the water is moving, pushing to 10-meter-long turbines with some 100 metric tons of pressure and continuously generating 2,000 megawatts MW, enough to power roughly 2,000 homes. For the entrepreneurs and researchers dedicated to harnessing that power, the ocean, that primordial space out of which so much of life on Earth emerged, seems destined to once again supply the forces that will help create a new phase of history. But as anyone who's ever battled the waves by boat or board knows, taming the tides will be a gargantuan task. The idea is simple. First, tides. They rise and fall predictably, relentlessly driven by the gravitational pull of the moon. Those traits combined make the tide an attractive proposition for powering the grid. The sun does not always shine. The wind does not always blow, notes Simon Forrest, the CEO of Scotland-based tidal power producer Nova Innovation. But with tidal, he says, we can tell you how much we'll be generating 2 minutes past 3 in the morning, a month from now, 5 years from now. Second, you need what is basically the equivalent of a wind turbine placed underwater, either moored to the seabed or attached to the underside of some floating structure, which drives a generator. And luckily, water is denser than air by some 800 times. You tend to get a more compact, powerful source of energy, says Forrest. Our turbines are a lot smaller than wind turbines, but produce a lot more bang for the buck. Nova, in particular, has other advantages. Where the O2 floats, Nova's turbines lie beneath the ocean surface. Our technologies are unaffected by storms, says Forrest. There's no visual impact, he says. Aesthetics have been a reason many people have objected to wind turbines in the past and do not create hazards for shipping or other marine operations. Nova billed its initial deployment in Scotland's Shetland Islands in 2016 as the world's first offshore tidal array. There are now six turbines in Shetland's Blue Mole Sound, powering homes and, thanks to a collaboration with Tesla, electric vehicle charge points as well. After the success of that project, authorities granted Nova a license to build a 50 MW array, which will provide up to one-third of Shetland's power. We have been producing clean, predictable power for 6 years in Shetland, says Forrest, and you do not see it. Another thing consumers on Shetland or Orkney do not see is the true price of their energy use on their monthly bills, thanks to government subsidies. For the technology to grow and spread globally, tidal energy companies will need to reduce costs through scale and technology-driven efficiency improvements. It is not a fantasy. For example, in the U.S., the price of wind power has fallen 70% over the past decade. There is a question of how mass deployment of tidal turbines might impact the seas. If you're putting something in the ocean that is extracting energy, you are perturbating the ocean, says Michaela De Dominicis, a senior scientist with the UK's National Oceanographic Centre. This can have cascading effects, like disrupting the nutrient mix of ocean ecosystems, as well as raising water temperatures. Her research suggests, however, that any disturbances may well be worth it. In one of my papers, I was showing that even if I'm putting like 20,000 turbines at sea and I'm perturbating the environment, she says, this effect is one order of magnitude less than what can happen with climate change. Tidal energy's biggest hurdle may simply be the limited number of places in the world where it is possible. In the U.S., aside from a small project in New York's East River, which powers the equivalent of fewer than 400 homes, few sites have been identified that have the promise of Scotland's waters. What the U.S. does have in abundance is coastline, which speaks to the promise of another ocean energy source, waves. Despite an early burst of enthusiasm for wave power a few decades ago, tidal has since eclipsed it, in part because the open seas make for a more challenging environment. It is an unconventional resource, says Andrew Scott, CEO of Orbital Marine, who previously worked at Pelamis, an early and now defunct wave power startup. Waves have a vertical excursion. They've got a horizontal excursion. They've got a cyclical motion. They've got buoyance force. They've got different wavelengths that come at different angles. There is no conceptual agreement as to how you're going to capture the energy. Given the potential payoff, however, people keep seeking new solutions. Inna Braverman, co-founder and CEO of the Israeli startup EcoWave Power, thinks that early wave power pioneers erred in trying to work far offshore. The price was sky high, she said. You need divers. You need to put all the conversion equipment inside the actual floaters that are in the middle of the sea. Her company instead affixes wave-driven generators to onshore features like breakwaters. A pilot project in Gibraltar has been providing power for roughly 100 homes since 2016 at a fraction of the cost of offshore wave products, she says. And the company is ramping up with megawatt-level projects in Portugal and most recently the port of Los Angeles. Whether it is moving on a wave or via the tide, water seems an integral part of the future energy equation. The low-hanging fruit of wind and solar has been plucked, says Cagney. To get to net zero, we are going to need every renewables resource we have got. And as the global impacts of the Russian invasion of Ukraine underscore, energy security requires having a diversity of inputs. There is an advantage in having an energy source driven by a different sort of forces, because it means they do not all align at the same time, says Forrest. If the wind doesn't blow, it does not stop the tide from flowing. And that was the cover story by Tom Vanderbilt. This is entitled Quick Talk. Blake Crouch, C-R-O-U-C-H. The novelist, on his latest thriller, Upgrade, which came out July 12, which tells the story of a gene editing scheme that threatens to change humanity forever. Annabelle Guterman writes this column. This appears in the question-answer format. Question, where did the inspiration for Upgrade come from? Answer, we are at this point in time where genetic engineering is on the precipice. Having complete control over the total human genome is a little bit out of reach, but it is right on the horizon. Question, you did a ton of research on gene editing. Was there anything you learned that stood out? Answer, the big thing I came away with is how afraid scientists are of this research and this technology. I did not realize how unnerved everyone was about the optimistic potential of this technology, but also the pitfalls that await us. Question, how much liberty did you take with the science? Answer, not as much as I thought I would have to take, which terrifies me. This book is going to be sold as science fiction, as a futuristic thriller, but I really don't think it is. We are already living in the future. I don't think science fiction exists anymore. All of the threats and promises in this book are at our fingertips. Jennifer Doudna, one of the co-creators of CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R, talks about having this nightmare of Hitler discovering it. That always stuck with me. The person who discovered this gene modification therapy is kept up at night, fearful of what might happen. Question, if not sci-fi, what is Upgrade? Answer, the book is set slightly in the future because I wanted to accelerate where some of the climate change and more in the weeds technology was heading. But it is a mirror of where we might be 5 minutes from now. I have 3 kids. I am uncertain. Everyone seems to feel that way. Are we going to be here prevalently as a species in 100 years, 75 years? It is a weird thing for a species with full sentience to contemplate its demise. The last dodo bird didn't know it was the last dodo bird. Question, are you purposefully nodding to COVID in the book? Answer, I started it in September 2019. My first attempt was a completely different way in. I had imagined doing almost a Jurassic Park thing, more about how gene editing could affect new life forms. Then COVID hit and I had this realization. Think about what we are going through right now. Why would I not be writing about this technology vis-a-vis humanity? I had written almost an entire novel, but ended up throwing that away and starting over. Last question. The world is a scary place right now. What gives you hope? Answer. There is a moment in the book where protagonist Logan says something like, "You can't sacrifice humanity to save humanity, because if you do, you're giving up the whole game." I fell into that like a trust fall. It is not necessarily my first instinct, but that is all we have at this point, trust and compassion. trust that we have gotten this far. We are ultimately a cooperative species. We have to trust that we're going to get through this very dark time together. There is a photo here of a youngish-looking man with reddish hair, short and slicked back on top, a small amount of reddish facial hair, a light complexion, perhaps brown eyes, but I can't see for sure, wearing brown-rimmed glasses, wearing gray, it looks like gray or gray-blue jeans, a gray T-shirt over which is a darker gray or even black jacket. He's looking at the camera, neither smiling nor frowning. He's just there. Here's a list of a few must-reads. Actually, it says more must-reads because upgrade, of course, was noted in the article. Okay, Lapvona, Lapvona, by Otessa Moshfegh, transports readers to a medieval land where a shepherd's son faces a power struggle that exposes human depravity. Now, these have all been released either in June or July. Sayaka Murata's Life Ceremony, 12 engrossing short stories translated from Japanese, subvert norms in order to probe intimacy and individuality. And Thrust by Lydia Yuknovich. In Lydia Yuknovich's novel, Lasev is a carrier, which means she can travel through time to connect with people from eras past. And Angela Haupt wrote that short column. Turning the page now to Time Off Recommends. And this is an LGBTQ plus reading and streaming list. Celebrate Pride all summer long with these books, shows, and movies by Eliza Berman, Judy Berman, and Angela Haupt. Fire Island is a movie. This modern take on Jane Austen relocates Pride and Prejudice from Georgian-era England to the titular gay vacation spot off the coast of Long Island. Joel Kim Booster and SNL's Bowen Yang play roles akin to the Bennett sisters. Television, Heartstopper. Adapted from a beloved YA comic, this starry-eyed Netflix teen romance follows a gay misfit at a British boys' school as he ends his secret trysts with a mean, closeted jock and falls for a sweet guy who actually respects him, but also happens to be a closeted rugby jock. Movie, Beauty. In this 80s set drama written and produced by Lena Waithe, a talented young singer balances her relationships with her girlfriend and parents, Niecy Nash and Giancarlo Esposito, with her desire to embark on a career in an industry that threatens to swallow her whole. Movie, Anything's Possible. Billy Porter has reached the heights of his career on stage with Tonys for Kinky Boots and as a producer of A Strange Loop, and on TV with an Emmy for Pose. In Porter's feature directorial debut on Prime Video, a trans high schooler, Eva Rain, R-E-I-G-N, experiences the highs and lows of her first boyfriend, Abu Bakr Ali. Book, Chef's Kiss. Simone is a pedantic pastry chef working in a Bon Appetit-style test kitchen. After her chirpy colleague Ray shares that they are non-binary, the pair shifts from work friends to something more. It is hard to say which aspect of T.J. Alexander's recently released novel is sweeter, the slow-burn romance or the drool-worthy desserts. Book, Our Wives Under the Sea. In Julia Armfield's novel, a marine biologist who was nearly lost at sea returns to a wife who had thought herself a widow. What ensues is a haunting juxtaposition of the horrors beneath the waves with a life and love on solid ground. Movie Crush. This charming recent Hulu release, whose producers include Natasha Lyonne, hits all the beats of the conventional teen rom-com. Girl harbors a secret crush, then falls in love with someone unexpected in pursuit of said crush, but this time with a lesbian romance at its center. Television, P Valley, that's capital P hyphen Valley. Katori Hall's Stars drama, set at a black-owned Mississippi Delta strip club, kicked off its second season with a socially distanced pole dance on the makeshift stage of a car wash. Along with Megan Thee Stallion's guest spot, one reason to keep watching is Nico Annan as the club's proprietor, the shrewd, sexy, genderqueer mother hen, Uncle Clifford. Under the heading Nation, Compromised State, with Roe v. Wade in the balance, a Time investigation finds anti-abortion pregnancy centers may expose women to new legal risks. This is by Abigail Abrams and Vera Bergengruen, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein and Simone Shaw. The first alarm bell went off in Ashley's head when no one at the Prestonwood Pregnancy Center was wearing a mask. No one was in scrubs. No one's hair was tied up, and every staffer was wearing a visible cross. I should have noticed all the red flags, says Ashley, 28, whom Time is identifying by her first name to protect her privacy. But it was not until she sat down for a mandated counseling session in the brick building in a Dallas suburb that she realized what kind of facility it was. Ashley had Googled where she could confirm a positive pregnancy test and get an abortion. One of the first results had been a website called Choices Dallas, offering pre-screening abortion consultations. That had led her to Prestonwood, one of more than 2,500 anti-abortion centers, sometimes known as crisis pregnancy centers, that have exploded across the U.S. over the past two decades, fueled by an increasingly powerful anti-abortion movement. This sprawling network of unregulated, faith-based nonprofits now outnumbers abortion clinics 3-1. Many of the millions of women who visit these pregnancy centers stumble into them by accident, as Ashley did. The centers often present themselves as medical facilities and mirror abortion clinics' logos using names like Your Choice and Women's Health Clinic. Prestonwood's, a P at the center of three concentric circles, looks very similar, for instance, to that of Planned Parenthood. Pregnancy centers' billboards, pregnant, scared, need help, blanket highways, and their well-funded parent organizations offer trainings in Google Ads, search engine optimization, social marketing, to ensure they appear atop search results. Their goal is to dissuade women from having abortions by promoting parenting and adoption, offering baby supplies and counseling. But researchers and doctors have found they also provide misinformation. More than half a dozen women who sought care at such centers told Time staff used a variety of scare tactics, including gory videos about abortion. Ashley had gone to Prestonwood in hopes of getting an ultrasound and information about abortion. She has a medical condition that puts her at high risk for an ectopic pregnancy, in which a fertilized egg implants outside the uterus. An egg cannot survive the condition, which can also threaten the life of the pregnant person. But Ashley says the Prestonwood counselor told her falsely she could carry an ectopic pregnancy to term if she was careful, and urged her to delay a decision to terminate the pregnancy. I said, okay, so you want me to wait until it becomes illegal for me to get an abortion, Ashley recalls. Referring to a recent Texas law that bans abortions after roughly 6 weeks of pregnancy. After leaving the center, Ashley broke down in tears in her car. A Prestonwood spokesperson told Time, it abides by all relevant laws and regulations, respects client privacy, and prioritizes the health of both mother and child. Ashley was later able to see a doctor and terminate her pregnancy within the time period Texas law still allows, but her visit to Prestonwood haunted her. In her interactions with the center, both over the phone and in person, she had unknowingly provided a ream of personal information to a religious anti-abortion group. She began to wonder what they would do with that data. They scanned my ID. They know where I live. They know my name. They have my F/King license number. It felt like a completely different violation. Her concerns are not unfounded, although privacy worries about location data and health apps have dominated recent headlines about sensitive abortion data. The troves of personal information that pregnancy centers collect and store arguably pose a much more immediate privacy risk, legal and privacy experts tell Time. Pregnancy centers, many of which are affiliated with national anti-abortion advocacy groups, including CareNet and Heartbeat International, collect personal data from the millions of women they interact with every year, in person, by telephone, and through online chats. This data includes sexual and reproductive histories, test results, ultrasound photos, and information shared during consultations, parenting classes, or counseling sessions, which some pregnancy centers require before they provide aid like diapers. Because most centers are not licensed medical clinics and offer services for free, privacy lawyers tell Time they are not legally bound by federal health data privacy laws. With the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade, these largely unregulated databases could be exploited in the wake of conservative efforts to criminalize abortion. Lawmakers in three states have already passed laws allowing private citizens to sue abortion providers, or in two states, anyone who aids in an abortion. Other proposed bills target the pregnant woman herself. Pregnancy centers' databases could be used as evidence in both launching and pursuing such legal actions. Because pregnancy centers often focus on outreach to women of color in urban areas, according to their own strategy reports, the clients are already disproportionately more likely to be surveilled and scrutinized by law enforcement. We anticipate we'll see a dramatic increase in the criminalization of pregnant people for self-managed abortion and pregnancy outcomes, says Kim Clark, a lawyer at Legal Voice, a women's rights nonprofit in Seattle. Pregnancy centers are just perfectly positioned to facilitate those investigations. The national anti-abortion organizations that run the largest networks of pregnancy centers say they protect their clients' privacy. That data is secure, Heartbeat International spokeswoman Andrea Trudden tells Time. Any information we publish and pull is just numbers, so we're not looking at any of that personal information. But some abortion rights advocates point to conflicts of interest. Heartbeat, which runs the largest network of pregnancy centers in the U.S., with 1,800 affiliates, also lobbies for bills criminalizing abortion. From law enforcement to human rights, one of the lessons of the past few decades is that privacy violations follow the creation of unregulated troves of data. Now, with the rollback of abortion rights, the cache of data on pregnant women represents arguably the most intrusive front yet. It is just nuts, says Mary Jo Daly, a Democratic state representative in Pennsylvania, who introduced a bill directed at pregnancy centers. They are collecting all this information, and you do not know how they're going to use it because they're not healthcare providers. And women don't know that. It is frightening. Small, locally operated pregnancy centers first cropped up in the 1960s as mostly Catholic groups looked to prevent abortion by offering mothers counseling and social service referrals. After the Supreme Court established a constitutional right to abortion in 1973, larger groups, including evangelical activists, joined the so-called pregnancy help movement, according to the Charlotte Lozier Institute, an anti-abortion think tank associated with Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America. As the movement grew larger, advocates began organizing independent pregnancy centers into networks, featuring annual conferences, training sessions, and digital and legislative strategies. What had once been mom-and-pop storefronts became the scaffolding of the national anti-abortion movement. Pregnancy centers go out of their way to perpetuate that idea that they are just volunteers trying to help at a storefront on the corner, says Megan Peterson, executive director at the legal nonprofit Gender Justice. There is a whole machine behind them. By the late 90s, conservative state lawmakers were channeling government funds to pregnancy centers to launch programs promoting sexual risk avoidance and alternatives to abortion. Close to 20% of pregnancy centers nationwide now receive public funding. 12 states funnel up to $8 million in taxpayer money every year to pregnancy centers, according to a 2021 report from Equity Forward, a reproductive rights research firm. Texas provides by far the most, $50 million a year. At least 33 states and the District of Columbia raise money for these centers by selling specialty Choose Life license plates. And at least 10 states have diverted funds to pregnancy centers from the Federal Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, which gives states block grants meant to help vulnerable families meet basic needs, including food, rent, and child care. As pregnancy centers spread nationally, many have rebranded themselves as medical clinics, borrowing the language and imagery of women's clinics, photos of people in white coats and exam tables in their promotional materials. Today, the vast majority of centers do not provide even basic women's health care, like pap smears, and many oppose the use of birth control. But 77% offer non-diagnostic ultrasounds, which do not provide any information about the health of an embryo, according to research by Andrea Schwarzendruber, an associate professor at the University of Georgia College of Public Health. This decision to go medical was part of a national strategy to draw in more women explicitly considering abortion, according to the Charlotte Lozier Institute. But the shift also compounded confusion over what the centers do. Our data show many people who go to crisis pregnancy centers have misconceptions about what the centers are, says Schwarzendruber, who surveyed people who visited Georgia pregnancy centers. Many were expecting an abortion facility or a medical facility. The ambiguity has been aided by internet search results. In the 13 states that are set to ban abortion quickly, Nearly 40% of Google Maps searches for abortion clinic near me and abortion pill led to pregnancy centers, according to the misinformation research nonprofit Center for Countering Digital Hate. The top two research results for abortion in Dallas lead to pregnancy center organization, including Choices Dallas, the website Ashley used. In the past decade, pregnancy centers again shifted their strategy, this time focusing on the power of data. In 2017, Heartbeat International rolled out a new data collection system for its pregnancy centers. Big data is revolutionizing all sorts of industries, its marketing materials trumpeted. The data your organization collects needs to work not just for you, but for the rest of the pregnancy help movement. Major pregnancy center networks now use data collection interfaces to track women who interact with their organization in person, on the phone, or online. Calling Heartbeat International's 24-hour hotline, which the organization says fields some 1,100 calls a day, or using its online chat bot, both require a visitor provide her name, location, demographic information, and what she plans to do with her pregnancy. These data collection systems allow pregnancy centers to create digital dossiers of women, or dossiers of women, according to a 2020 report by UK-based civil rights group Privacy International, which warned that while these technologies collect and centralize vast amount of people's private information, it is unclear who the data is shared with. You do not need to physically go to a crisis pregnancy center anymore for them to harvest your data, says Tara Murtha of Women's Law Project, a legal advocacy group. They have it the moment you seek help on their website or use the chat app. During in-person consultations and counseling sessions, pregnancy center staff use the same data systems, which often feature drop-down menus or color-coded systems to categorize how likely a client is to get an abortion. Perhaps most worrisome to abortion rights advocates is the trend among pregnancy centers to reach out to women who've already had abortions, often by offering post-abortion counseling. Heartbeat International also runs an abortion pill reversal hotline directed at women who've started medical abortions. While the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says there is no specific evidence suggesting abortion pill reversal works, the women who call the hotline asking about it are still asked to provide personal data. If abortion's illegal, that interaction carries potential legal implications, says Murtha. You're on record, she says, as having been pregnant and attempted an abortion. Unlike data gathered at real medical clinics, client information collected by pregnancy centers is mostly unregulated by federal law. The centers are not generally subject to federal privacy laws, including the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA, which governs healthcare settings. State privacy laws vary widely, but only a few states require pregnancy centers offering medical services to be licensed, according to a 2020 report from the Charlotte Lozier Institute. In reviewing more than two dozen pregnancy center privacy disclosures, Time found many reference HIPAA and assure broad data privacy, but most of the time such promises are legally toothless, since HIPAA does not apply, says Shannon Hartsfield, a lawyer at Holland and Knight who focuses on corporate compliance and data privacy. They may say, oh, we keep everything confidential, she says, but it's going to be hard to know for sure without legal standards. The fine print on pregnancy center forms and websites is also expansive. According to the terms of use on Heartbeat International's data management system, the organization can share any and all client information with any affiliates, partners, vendors, or contract organizations, or as legally necessary. Anti-abortion leaders, as well as staff at local pregnancy centers, tell Time they have no intention of breaching their clients' privacy. In May, after Louisiana lawmakers advanced a bill classifying abortion as homicide and allowing pregnant women to be charged, a coalition of anti-abortion groups published an open letter urging state legislators to stop. The mainstream pro-life movement absolutely opposes prosecuting women, and that extends to pregnancy centers. National Right to Life Committee spokeswoman Laura Echevarria tells Time. The sponsor of the Louisiana bill later pulled it in the face of public opposition. Echevarria and others say pregnancy centers are a crucial part of the future of maternal care. A Heartbeat International survey showed 41% of centers in Texas and surrounding states have seen an uptick in clients since Texas' abortion ban took effect in September. Heartbeat spokeswoman Trudden says the organization's primary concern is the recent increase in vandalism and threats to its centers, not data security. Even as abortion clinics have moved to paper forms and encrypted apps to protect clients' information, Trudden says their centers are not making changes. We have not received increased concerns by pregnancy health organizations regarding their data security. Echevarria adds pregnancy centers have a vested interest in fighting law enforcement requests to access their databases. It would completely undermine and destroy the mission of pregnancy centers, she says, to have to give that information to anybody, to any court of law. But the legal landscape is changing rapidly. Texas' six-week abortion ban offers a $10,000 reward to anyone who wins a civil case against either an abortion provider or someone who aided in an abortion. Oklahoma also offers $10,000 in its sweeping abortion ban, which went into effect in May. A similar law in Idaho is only blocked in court while Roe, or was only blocked in court while Roe was still standing. By offering a substantial monetary reward, the Texas, Oklahoma, and Idaho laws and the National Right to Life Model Bill potentially create a powerful motivation for anyone who has access to pregnancy center databases. The data, says Peterson of Gender Justice, literally has a price tag on it. That includes pregnancy center staff, partners, vendors, and contract organization. The staff of which are presumably involved in this advocacy work because they believe having an abortion is tantamount to murder. A front desk attendant and spiritual counselor at Brazos Pregnancy Center in Texas, who declined to give her name, told Time that while the center's goal was to protect the client and their baby, she personally is in the middle on whether a woman should face criminal charges for having an abortion. The Opelousas Pregnancy Center in Louisiana goes further. Its policies promise to treat clients with kindness, compassion, and in a caring manner, while also asserting abortion by any means for any reason is unjustified and an act of murder. Pregnancy centers' increasingly close ties to state governments present yet another concern, multiple legal and privacy experts tell Time. Last year, Arkansas passed a law requiring women seeking an abortion to call an abortion alternatives hotline, which in many cases would direct them to a pregnancy center. The same law requires such callers be given a unique identifying number, which would then be registered in a state database. Five other states are considering similar legislation. Arkansas State Representative Jim Dotson, who authored the bill, told Time he opposes efforts to criminalize pregnant women and said the data gathered would be secure. But privacy experts say current law cannot ensure that. In May, Daley, the Pennsylvania Democrat, introduced a bill barring the 156 pregnancy centers in the state from sharing women's health data without their consent. They get state money, Daley tells Time, but they're not transparent. They're not accountable. Meanwhile, Ashley, the woman who visited the pregnancy center near Dallas, says she is not sure where her data is stored or who has access to it, and she cannot help but feel someone is looking over her shoulder. I was within the legal bounds to have an abortion, she says, but honest to God, it would not surprise me if someone were to knock on my door to see if I was still pregnant. I mean, it's terrifying. That lengthy article was slightly abridged. It was written by Abigail Abrams and Vera Bergen-Gruen, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein and Simone Shaw. Rock star and poet Serhiy Zhadan is fighting for the future of Ukrainian culture. And that name is spelled S-E-R-H-I-Y space Z-H-A-D-A-N, so I apologize if I'm pronouncing it incorrectly. This will probably be abridged for purposes of time. It's written by Amanda Coakley, with reporting by Maria Vinogradova, London. As Russian shells rain down on Ukraine, the country's most beloved poet cannot write. The inspiration is there, the tale of a school teacher who shepherded 10 children away from the front line after being told by the Ukrainian military there was no hope of escape. Old friends in Kharkiv who risk their lives to get neighbors to a shelter. Or the discovery of mass graves across Ukraine. Over the past 20 years, Serhiy Zhadan has written more than a dozen books of poetry and 7 novels. He's also part of the ska-punk band Zhadan and the Dogs. Now, though, it is impossible to get the ink to flow. Everything's happening too fast. I cannot write poetry or prose right now, Zhadan says during a video call from his apartment in Kharkiv. But music somehow keeps up. I go to the music studio, and together with the band, we got some songs out. It's therapy. Then we go out and perform for our people. Mention Zhadan's name in Ukraine, and eyes light up. The 47-year-old's work has long given voice to life in the Donbas, a predominantly industrial region of eastern Ukraine. In his work, Zhadan paints the region where he was born and raised as one intertwined with Russian culture, but that is, first and foremost, Ukrainian. He belongs to a long line of poets playing a crucial role in Ukrainian culture. Our leaders, for a long time, were not kings or queens, but poets, Zhadan says. Serhiy Plukhsy, a professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard University, says many important monuments in Ukraine are dedicated to 19th-century poet Taras Shevchenko, who was born a serf in 1814 and went on to champion political liberalization for Ukraine. He is considered to be the father of the modern Ukrainian nation, Plukhy says. That's P-L-O-K-H-Y. Writers also played a major role in the country's achieving independence in 1991, he adds. Zhadan is part of this activist poet tradition. At a time when Russian President Vladimir Putin seeks to erase the very existence of Ukraine, he has denied Ukraine has its own authentic statehood, literature and art take on new meaning. They can ensure the country's spirit is not lost to Kremlin propaganda. When reports first reached Zhadan about Russia's invasion, He was on a train heading west from Ukraine's second largest city, Kharkiv, for a concert. Should Anna and his six bandmates turn back, they would not abandon the city in its hour of need. It is not the first time Jadon has felt called to action. Back in 2004, he established a tent city in Kharkiv during the Orange Revolution, protests that called out corruption and Russian meddling in Ukraine's presidential election. And during the Maidan Revolution, which in 2014 drove out Viktor Yanukovych, a Kremlin-backed authoritarian president, he was one of its leaders in Kharkiv. Jadon became such a prominent figure in the Maidan Revolution that when pro-Russian demonstrators found him in an occupied government building, they dragged him out, pushed him to his knees, and told him to kiss the Russian flag. He refused and was so severely beaten, he was hospitalized. I told them to go F space CK themselves, he wrote on his Facebook page following the incident. These days, Jadon and the dogs have rolled up their sleeves to help with volunteer efforts and perform concerts for people sheltering from Russian bombs in Kharkiv's metro. Usually dressed in black skinny jeans and a biker jacket, Jadon spends his days in a flurry of activity across the city, organizing cultural events and fundraisers for Ukraine's war effort. Since the early days of Russia's assault on Ukraine, Kharkiv has been on the front line. Authorities estimate more than half the city's pre-war population of 1.4 million has fled. Key landmarks like Freedom Square have been subjected to heavy shelling, leaving only burned-out husks of once grand building. It's a city Jadon called home for decades. That article was abridged because we've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. 832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.